Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Today, when political disagreement becomes corrosive demonization, this issue of identity and stereotypes is so thorny that we've returned to it again. And today, we're trying something a bit unusual. At 9, we're talking about the most destructive stereotypes that are lobbed at Republican voters. You know them, racist, sexist, haters, and why it feels righteous if you're on the other side to cling to these tropes. At 11, we're doing the same with Democrats, those lefty, God-hating, never-met-a-government-program-they-didn't-love stereotypes that the other side indulges in. This is a show for deeper thinking. So as we start the two-part discussion today, I'd ask you to acknowledge this. Humans and voters are complicated, multidimensional. Labels are one-dimensional. In other words, I don't want to get calls from people saying, if you voted for Donald Trump, you're a racist, end of the conversation. Because the conversation is not ending there, and it's going on at 9 and 11. So if we're going to make the discussions meaningful today, I need you to do your best thinking. If you're a Republican voter, are those labels about you hurtful? Do you think they're fair? Democrats, do you really think they sum up all Republican voters? And what do you think is misunderstood about who you are as a Republican voter? So I'm asking to hear from Republican voters first here on the show. And I want you to talk about what it feels like to be labeled with some of these stereotypes. And then I'd like some Democrats in the audience here to do some thinking about whether those stereotypes at Republicans are really fair. Okay, here comes the number. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and I'm on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Our guest today, Joaquin Munoz, is with us. He's a Better Angels citizen moderator, and he's with me in the studio. You ready for this, Joaquin?
I believe I am. Good morning.
Okay, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Eddie Glaude is with us. He's a professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton, and he joins me today from Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And Eddie, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. It's great to be back.
So, Eddie, a bit more emphasis here on why I think this discussion is going to be uncomfortable but productive. Why do you think these one-dimensional stereotypes end up having so much currency in our political arena, and why they feel good to the people that are using them? What do you think?
Well, you know, we always use shorthands in conversation. So, you know, pain, the word pain is a shorthand for complex, you know, synapses and neurological occurrences in the body, but we say, I have a pain in my knee. We don't describe all of the particulars, right?
Right.
And so we use shorthands to get about, and it's easier that way. And so I think we say a person is Republican, and we think that that description captures the entire complexity of the person in front of us. And if we hold a particular view of the world, when we say that someone is a Republican, it carries a kind of moral weight, a kind of ethical judgment.
Right.
Because it's a way of distinguishing them. Their worldview is X as represented by the label Republican. And that can make you feel good, just as when we say that that person is a bad person, or that person is immoral, or that person exhibits bad character. It's a moral judgment. It's an ethical judgment. Typically those judgments follow from assessments of practices or behaviors. But in our political discourse, those, you know, these shorthands work and actually reveal a kind of laziness in our thinking. We just use them to kind of move about and just place people in their corners in order to avoid or evade hard conversations like we're trying to have this morning.
And let me grab a call just to write what you've just spoken about, Eddie, to Lori in Montevideo. Lori, you're a conservative, is that right?
Yes, I am.
What do you think of these labels? Do they define you in some way? Do they encompass who you are?
No, they do not at all.
Why?
No, I like to consider myself a conservative more than a Democrat or Republican, and I believe in conservatism because I think the United States needs to be strong in order financially in order to help so much of the world that is so impoverished. I mean, there's people that are still out hunting and gathering during, you know, and in order for us to help when there's terrible disasters, you know, natural disasters in the world. So I don't want to have America be strong so I can have more and be more greedy. I want to be strong so that we can help other people. So the labels bother me terribly because I'm viewed as greedy and I just want more. Another thing that bothers me is I have sensed that there's just so much waste out there. That's I think the money can be there. I want money to be spent wisely. So I don't see myself as this horrible, greedy person, but I definitely think people out in different parts of the country, you're almost in the closet if you're a conservative.
Joaquin just chuckled on that. Do you hear that, Joaquin, in some of your Better Angels forums, that people don't feel emboldened or brave enough to really talk about their political opinion?
Quite frequently. I conducted a small skills session at the university not too long ago, and a young man came in who was interested in participating in the workshop. I asked him to identify for the purposes of the workshop's functioning, and when he identified as a conservative, he got very, 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 very quiet and started whispering and wouldn't speak to me. I turned around to go and help another participant, and when I turned back, that young man had left the room and he didn't return. So there's absolutely some fear about presenting one's perspective as a conservative. And I think in large part it's because in many ways that word has been tied to demonic beliefs about what that person is and what they do.
Yeah, Eddie, one of the things that I'm reinforcing in these conversations today and that I did with Flyover as well is differences, not demonization. But aren't we in a place, in a moment here in our politics where all you have to do is say, I'm a conservative or I'm a Democrat, and there's a lot of space to be demonized for that?
Sure, I think so. But let me say this. It's very difficult to avoid making the move. And what I mean by that, to make the move from the position held to a judgment about the character of the person who holds the position.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is a person who says, for example, that they support the idea of raising the rent for HUD, for the, you know, for people who live in HUD housing by $150 and to put work burdens on them because they're lazy and they really don't want to work, right? It becomes very difficult to kind of not make the jump or the leap from holding that view about poor people to the character of the person who holds that view, right? So I'll give you another example. It's very difficult to say or not to say that when Paul Ryan and Republicans in the House pass a tax bill that blows the debt wide open in the name of, in some ways, here's a biased rendering, a redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich, and then claim that the deficit is the rationale to go after quote-unquote entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and the like. And you can't say, that's disingenuous, right? And it's very difficult not to make the leap that this particular position is not just simply a reflection of your view,
right,
but a reflection of your character. That's what's hard here, right? Because you're trying to assess not just simply you are free to hold your opinion, but what are the effects of that opinion in the world, and people are making substantive moral judgments about those effects.
A call here from David in Astorville, Iowa. Hey, David, hi. Glad you heard the show and called in. How are you wrestling with this?
Well, I'm kind of a different mindset in that I'm a social conservative and a fiscal liberal.
Uh-huh. yeah, that is different than the usual.
It is different. I'm a minister. And so one of the things that I see is from a social conservative side, I believe that Republicans, for the most part, which for my whole life, most of what I voted for is Republican.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that I found somebody who would be considered a Democrat that is a pro-life, pro-family Democrat. I only found it one time in my life, and it was Joe Donnelly out of Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and a fantastic guy who really helped me out personally. And truly, it was one of those things where I believe that if we can help people, we should help people.
Okay.
And, you know, when the whole thing was happening with President Trump and running for election, I had difficulties even within my own family where people couldn't believe that I was voting for Trump or that I was aboard the Trump train, so to speak.
David, let me ask you this, since we have so many other callers.
Sure.
Would you feel free to tell your congregation, and I don't mean from the pulpit on Sunday, I mean in some
right.
casual conversation, would you feel free to tell members of your congregation that you voted for the president?
Yes, absolutely. And my reasoning for it, because even as he was being elected, there were some people who kind of balked at that, even within the congregation. And my reasoning was very simple in that I'm not voting for a moral character. Hmm. I believe that most politicians, with rare exceptions, most are all corrupt.
Wow.
I
okay.
absolutely believe that most are in the pocket of somebody.
So you were voting.
Said,
you were voting for policies that you liked that the president was talking about. And let me bring this back to Joaquin. Here's something that I think has really deepened the polarization, which Joaquin, as I said in the introduction, all of the leaps of assumptions and character judgments that are made when someone says, I'm a Republican and I voted for President Trump. Why is that leap so abbreviated today and so powerful?
Well, I think one thing to point out right off the bat in the experiences that I've had both in the Better Angels and in conversations is that most people don't legitimately believe the stereotypes that they hold, which is a really
is
fascinating
right?
thing to me. So folks will come to these immediate jump snap conclusions about a person they've just learned about or a person they've just heard. And through talking, through conversation, through communication, and through establishing relationship, start to see that that stereotype doesn't hold. Maybe not completely and not totally. So what's really interesting to me is that we do have a very powerful adherence to these stereotypes that we have in mind mm-hmm. about various groups of people. But when we really, really, really think about it and take a moment to reflect on what that stereotype tells us, whichever direction it goes, we start to recognize that that stereotype isn't real.
I don't know that we're in a place, though, with the reinforcement of social media and the media that you can take in that reinforces, you know, the echo chamber kind of quality of the media today.
No.
Where you ever have to really confront that.
Right. We really don't. We really don't have to. We have a luxury of not ever having to confront that if we don't want to. And for me, this is one of the beauties of what the Better Angels attempts to do, which is attempting to bring down some of those barriers by putting you in front of another person with ideas, with beliefs, with values, and doing your best to really understand where they're coming from, what they mean, what they're saying, and why they're saying it. It's a very different, very, very, very different dynamic.
Eddie, a part of the reason I really wanted you on the show today was because I follow you on Twitter, and I see some of what you're tweeting about the president's policies. And I wondered if in your life as a, you know, as a professor at Princeton and somebody who wants civil conversation, how you deal with this yourself about not being too corrosive, right, in the judgments that you're making about the president and those who follow.
Right. It's hard. It's hard, to be honest with you, because in some ways, Carrie, all of this presumes that the person that we're engaging in conversation is engaging in good faith. That the positions that are being put forward are the positions actually held,
mm-hmm.
and that they're not underlying assumptions about me, about black and brown people, for example, about LGBTQ folks, that inform the policy position. So what I've done in my public life is to try to have conversations across the aisle where we smoke out whether or not, you know, bad faith is present,
mm-hmm.
but rather to extend the presumption of good faith to my interlocutors. So I'm on Morning Joe a lot. And Joe and I, Joe Scarborough is a conservative. And many
sorta.
Of the folks on the show are conservative.
Yeah.
I'm on Nicole Wallace. She was the communications director for George W. Bush. And we find ourselves, I find myself in these circles with people with whom I have profound disagreements with. And the basis of the discussion, right, has to always be that I take it that they're engaging me in good faith, and then I can listen. When the assumption is that my interlocutor is actually lying to me, mm-hmm. is actually being disingenuous,
mm-hmm.
when they say they support small government, for example, that really small government is an assumption, is a position that's driven by a set of assumptions about big government redistributing monies from hardworking white people to lazy black and brown people, right? When there are all of these coded assumptions informing the conversation, what happens is that then we retreat into our corners.
Right.
Because we haven't smoked out those assumptions. And then the assumption, and I'll cut it short here, the presumption is that I am supposed to take the risk that you're being truthful with me.
Exactly. And you used a word that we haven't used yet, which is really important, and that's code. Joaquin, a lot of us are trying to break the code, you know, two layers down from what's really being said to one another, which I know is something that you're trying to do with Better Angels, right?
Absolutely. One of the things that I can mention is one of our workshops, for example, one of our workshops asks a group of reds and a group of blues to come together to have conversations around stereotypes, exactly what the show is discussing. We separate the two groups. A group of reds sits with a moderator, a group of blues sits with a moderator, and they facilitate a discussion around stereotypes that are had about your party by the other side. After some brainstorming and thinking about it, then they're asked to talk about why those stereotypes are inaccurate. Then they're asked to identify whether there is any small kernel of truth contained within the stereotype.
Look for the weaknesses or the truth of your own side.
Exactly.
Okay.
And to take an opportunity to be a little humble about
right.
knowing that that while you might believe that your side is righteous and completely unimpeachable, everybody has imperfections. And it's really interesting at this point where folks begin to recognize that that blanket stereotype doesn't apply to everybody, but there might be some truth to it at a particular time or for a small segment of the group, or sometimes just in the heat of rhetoric, rather than arguing about a policy or a process, you just sling something at somebody in an attempt to shut the conversation down. And it's a really interesting moment to watch folks recognize that's what people believe about me. This is not accurate,
right?
But I could see how somebody could come to that conclusion.
Yeah, and then what does it mean if I believe that about them?
Right,
right,
right.
There might be a kernel, but is it fair to lay the whole blanket over?
Right. At the end of that exercise, we bring folks together and they have a sharing session where one person shares the reds, one person shares the blues, and it's always a fascinating thing to watch people's responses as they recognize. And I think the most important thing that comes out of this is recognizing that the stereotype doesn't hold and that folks are able to be self-critical about their own positions and their own perspectives.
I also want to add to this that the stereotypes can be painful.
Absolutely.
I mean, they can really be corrosive and I think have contributed to the polarization. If you've just tuned into the show, this is a two-part discussion today. We're talking about when political disagreement and difference becomes corrosive demonization. How that happens, how to step away from that, some of the tools, some of the ideas that inform the ability to look beyond these political stereotypes. This hour, we're talking about stereotypes about Republicans. At 11 o'clock, we're going to be talking about stereotypes about Democrats. For now, I'm asking you, If you're a Republican voter, are those labels about you hurtful? Is there a kernel of truth that perhaps you're not comfortable with? Democrats, do you really think these stereotypes sum up Republican voters? And I'm asking for you, and you're with me on this, to do some deeper thinking on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Eddie Glaude with us from Princeton. Joaquin Munoz with us as a Better Angels citizen moderator. Here's John on Twitter who says, there was no shortage of information, Ray, what Trump was about before the election. His business acumen and leadership were at best questionable. If you voted Trump, you own him as a whole. Eddie, speak to that, because that's really kind of oppositional to what we're trying to do today. But I know a lot of people feel that way.
Right. I mean, among Clinton supporters, I own Trump because I wasn't a Clinton supporter. Right. So I get that from the other side as someone to the left of Clinton. But there is a kind of assumption that, you know, why would you support someone whose campaign began with an attack on the citizenship of President Obama, birtherism, right, whose campaign took off in the midst of very hateful rhetoric with regards to undocumented workers and the issue of immigration? What would allow you to embrace someone who in some ways turned his back on the basic moral norms that define a certain segment of the Republican Party? And this is pretty important, I think, when we have these sorts of discussions, Carrie. There are a couple of things that are at work. It's not just simply the individual encounter. Those encounters are weighted by history.
All right.
They're weighted by kind of social knowledge that informs and shapes what becomes the shorthand or the stereotype. So when we find out, for example, that it was really cultural issues driving the Trump voter, according to some exit poll data, that what was really driving the support of Trump was not so much economic insecurity, but the sense that America was transforming at a pace that made folk insecure,
mm-hmm,
that the idea of the country becoming a majority-minority nation, that the images of interracial marriages or interracial couples on commercials across television, that the idea of urban cosmopolitan cities defining the country had made people uneasy. They wanted America to be great again. They wanted America to hearken. They wanted to hearken back to the 1950s. And what's distinctive about that? So when we begin to unpack it, it generates all of these suspicions that then result in a crude shorthand. It must be racism that's motivating this. It must be a kind of cultural chauvinism that's motivating this. And given the history of the country, in some instances, it's not an unreasonable assumption, but it's an assumption that shuts down the possibility of conversation.
All right. Call here from Melissa. By the way, if you're getting a busy signal, try us back. And if you're calling to say something about an individual candidate, I think that's not really what we're looking for today. We're looking for some wider philosophical political thinking, and I've described kind of where the show is going on this. So we may ask you to call back on another day and open that phone line for somebody that wants to talk about this in a larger sense. To Melissa in Minneapolis. Hey, Melissa, thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you so much. As a former Republican myself, I came to this country when I was 10 and I became a citizen in my early 20s and have always voted Republican. But this year, this last election, especially with the anti-immigrant rhetoric, I could no longer be complicit with the hatred that was perpetuated by the candidates' words. I ended up voting independent, and I'm kind of a conservative without a party. And I think that a lot of immigrants can resonate with that, especially Latino immigrants, because mm-hmm, we come from Catholic communities where divorce, is not an option, where we're pro-life, where we have conservative values, and yet the Latino Catholicism has such compassion for people as well, that we can't just blindly align to a party without being holistically pro-life, which means to take care of the marginalized in all stages of life, not just the preborn.
You know, Melissa, you remind me that the parties and the candidates, Joaquin, are not helpful on this. I mean, I think American voters have to get around and beyond the parties and the candidates, because they're speaking to their, you know, diehard activists. And a lot of American voters can't be stuck in that trap of using that kind of language and falling into those labels. What would you say?
Melissa's call gave me chills because it's indicative of something that I learned very quickly as I started this Better Angels work, which was the absolute heartfelt compassion and amazing spirit of people, mm-hmm. and how incredibly complex they are. Because most people might hear Melissa's story without the particulars and say immigrant and label all kinds of stuff to
her. I know everything I need to know about her. She said one thing and now I can make all these assumptions.
Already done. And it could happen with any of those indicators that she put out. Immigrant, Latino, Catholic, any of those. What's interesting about that is bringing all of that together and recognizing just how incredibly complex people are. One of the things we do during our skills workshop in the listening skills section is we ask people to listen compassionately and try to find the value. Getting beyond the policy, getting beyond the rhetoric about whichever candidate they happen to vote for, and trying to get down to what is the thing that you value? What is the thing that you're holding close to your heart? And based on being able to identify those kinds of mutual values, there is the opportunity for some conversation to happen. We can both agree that fairness is important. We might just manifest it in different ways, but can we talk about some of the commonality that we share because we both have this strong adherence to this idea of compassion, to this idea of fairness, to this idea of being helpful, even if it means different things to different people? And I think it's really important to note some of that commonality and to accept, as hard as it is to do, and love the fact that we are such incredibly complex people. Nobody is simple. Nobody is simple. And that's part of what makes this Better Angels work challenging and also incredibly rewarding.
Eddie, I think we have to talk about the purpose of this too, because true to form, I'm hearing from a number of people on social media who are saying, this doesn't solve anything. Here's a listener who's saying, Carrie's having another conversation. It's the tone of the conversation that's the problem. The tone is not the problem. The politics are. I think we better zero in again on the purpose of this. We can go on in our polarized bunkers, or we can try something that we're suggesting today. Where do you come in on that?
Well, look, I think right now there is an amazing political realignment happening in the country where the traditional political categories don't capture what's going on the ground. And who's defining, the people who are defining the political landscape in so many ways are deep partisans in both Democratic and the Republican Party.
Right.
That's not to say that the folks who aren't in those parties are in the center. No, the center is going to change as the political spectrum realigns, right? What constitutes the center? And what I think is that people, Joaquin had hit this point right on the head. In so much of our interactions with one another, we don't see the human being right in front of us. We don't experience the person who's talking, who inhabits our space, with whom we share space, with whom we stand in association. We use the shorthand to move quickly through the interaction. And what folks are beginning to see, I mean, and let's just take it, for example, with the recent special election in Arizona. So here's a decidedly conservative district that Mitt Romney won by 25 percentage points. Trump won by 21 percentage points. And a Democrat who put forward a progressive agenda that was to the left of the Democratic National Committee yeah. only lost by 5 to 6 percentage points.
Good point. What does that tell us, right?
It tells us that people on the ground are less interested in political labels
right.
and more interested in policies that affect their life chances, their life worlds. They're trying to raise their babies. They're trying to pay their house note. They're trying to pay the car note. They're trying to save for a future generation. And so irrespective of these labels, right? We're talking about actual policy. So that's the first issue. And then how we talk to each other matters. We have lived, I came of age politically in the age of Reagan. My political life has been saturated by coded speech, mean-spirited dog whistles, right? Folks who have traded in stereotype for political gain, who've exploited political fears. And as a result, we all retreated into our bunkers and just drew on our shorthands, you know, claimed our fellows, our political allies, and decried our political enemies. And the result is a country in decline. So if we don't, in some ways, try to model, as you're trying to do today, Carrie, a more substantive conversation where we engage, as Joaquin suggests, the human being right in front of us in all of her complexity, we will doom the country to the fate that it seems to the road that it seems to be on,
right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Joaquin, something that Eddie talked about being in relationship with people resonated with you, especially with your Better Angels work. How so?
Absolutely. Once I started doing the moderating work and having sat through several discussions with folks who don't align with my political worldview, it occurred to me that because we were occupying the same space, either because we were in the same city or whatever, however you define that, we are in relationship with each other by default.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that relationship, because that exists, then I was making a decision to engage in conversations, to engage in exercises, to engage in creating vessels for people to converse with each other that assumed that the relationship was important. Better Angels doesn't teach you how to argue to win. It doesn't teach you how to change people's minds. It doesn't assume that any of that is what's important. It assumes that's what is important is building the relationships between folks and understanding that even if we are on different sides of a spectrum, there is still space for us to be in relationship that is not about creating enemies. And I remember having this very deep experience of understanding that and my mind just being completely blown away when I recognized I'm in relationship with all of these people. How am I going to approach that?
What also a mind shift, a worldview shift on I'm not in this argument to win? Isn't that why most of us think the purpose of argument is?
Oh, absolutely.
Somehow persuade the person we're arguing with of the folly of their view.
Of the folly of their view, which they're trying to do the exact same thing to
right.
us at the same time.
And it probably isn't going to happen in that moment.
It probably isn't going to happen in that moment. And perhaps it could. Perhaps with some ability to relate to somebody.
Right.
But if you think about your personal relationships and convincing somebody,
right.
come to this restaurant that I love, people don't just buy into your idea because you've said it. It takes time. It takes relationship. It takes the ability to build rapport with people before you can begin to share all of the ideas.
Call here from Mary in Minneapolis. Hi, Mary. How are you thinking about this as you listen in?
Yes. I totally believe that people are complex and stereotypes may not fit. However, I just feel like people are getting a pass. I feel like real people are getting hurt by some of the policies. And granted, that's happened over generations with different administrations. I get that. But in this instance, I feel like, no, we're not letting people in from Syria. We're sending people back to different countries and they've never even lived there. They're children. And I feel like when people come together to talk about things, it's the wrong people talking. It's like the Better Angels is great, clearly, but if you sat down with somebody, if you voted for Trump and then you sat down with someone who got sent back to a country and they're really struggling, how do you reconcile that? Do we just give everyone a pass? That's where I really struggle, you know, in talking to people who have different opinions, I guess, about this. And, you know, going back to the pastor who said he voted for Trump, and I think, you know, I don't know this person at all, but I think you voted for Trump and he's hurting real people, and yet you're a pastor and you're supposed to help people. And I just don't know how to wrap my head around that. I would like to forgive people and say it's fine, all these things that are going on, but I really have a hard time giving people.
This is the perfect call at just the right time, because Eddie, I noted three or four words that Mary was using there: forgive, hurting people, give people a pass. So I think that's language that's important in trying to dispel this idea that I will win the argument and I need to forgive you for your views and you're only about the candidate that you supported. What would you say?
Well, I mean, so it's a really, really important point, right? That there are consequences that follow from the positions that we hold, mm-hmm. that we take, and that people are harmed by the positions we take. Now, how do we engage one another in debate, conversation, argument? And those are three very different things, right? To be in conversation with someone, to have an argument with someone, to have a debate with someone. Those aren't the same kinds of interactions. How do we do that without judging, without taking the moral high ground?
Right.
In some ways. And is it the case that we, and here I'm struggling, and I really need some help here, is it the case that we have to avoid taking the moral high ground in some of these instances because of the stakes that are at play? So I'm struggling because I think it's important for us to see that there are consequences and that our task in engaging our fellows with different views is not just simply to make them comfortable in those views.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. It really does. I mean, this is the conundrum, I think, of the Better Angels model, which is I'm not just a vessel for you to, in this relationship we're in, pour in what I think are views that are hurtful and have consequences. And yet, I want to be able to be in some kind of relationship and see you as the multidimensional person that you are.
Right.
Right. Right.
Right. I mean, there's you know, oftentimes what happens in these arguments is that we lose sight of the humanity of
That's
the person right in front
exactly.
of us. And the moment we demonize, the moment we make them moral monsters, the possibility of fellowship, of genuine association, is lost with that particular person. But, and here's that's the negating conjunction, but sometimes we confront choices, political choices, moral choices, that lead us to believe that, or ask the question, lead us at least to ask the question, how could you hold that view? What is it about you that would lead you to make that claim? They're babies. How could you hold that view and see what's happening? Right? You could say that to someone who's a pro-lifer, or you could say that to someone who supported Hillary Clinton when she said, send the babies back.
Exactly right.
To Honduras, right? So I mean, this is the hard part, right? That we have to figure out how to block that subsequent move, that the position reflects that you are, in fact, a moral monster.
Joaquin, Eddie, how do you do that? Yeah.
Eddie asked the perfect question, and this applies directly to my own experience, where coming into this work, I asked the question, how could you possibly believe that?
Mm-hmm.
Not recognizing that somebody could ask the exact same question of me and my own beliefs,
right.
Because of course I'm right. So it took me some time and some personal interactions with folks to recognize that the question I needed to ask was, can you explain to me how you come to believe the things that you believe? Because even embedded, whether it's coming from somebody who believes that they are pro-life and is arguing with somebody who is pro-choice, when either of those two people says, how could you possibly believe that, there's a judgment embedded in that. And that's really, really hard. And I share Eddie's struggle around seeing what goes on and seeing the impacts in the world of the decisions that we make. And my hope is that by having these kinds of conversations, not only part of our skills workshop is not only being able to speak your piece, but it's also about being able to listen to somebody else.
Kara, can I ask Joaquin a question really
quick?
I know we've got to get to the phones. But how do we do that in a world that doesn't presume that it isn't kind of relativistic? And what I mean by that is that you have your view and I have my view. Is it the case that somebody's wrong in all of this? I mean, you see what I'm saying? It's not just... You know, when I ask, how can you hold that view?
Right.
And then the same person is asking me the same thing. But one of us is wrong, right?
Maybe. It's really hard. It's really, really hard. Depending on whose side you're standing on, you are absolutely right and the other person is absolutely wrong. What I hope, and the personal experience that I've had going through these workshops and conducting these workshops, is recognizing the difficulty of this question, and it causes self-reflection on my part.
Absolutely.
And I have to go back and not only examine, do I really understand and believe those stereotypes that I purport about the other?
Right.
Is my position really what I think it is? And is there any potential for flexibility? I'll give you a personal story real fast. One of a friend of mine came and talked to me, and he said, I really didn't like this workshop, but I'm glad I stuck through it. I was really concerned that you were going to be coming down on my side. He was identified as conservative.
Uh-huh.
And I said, just out of curiosity, I don't know a whole lot about conservative viewpoints. Will you please tell me what it is about your viewpoint? And he said, among other things, the most important one was guns. And so I said, that's interesting. Tell me about that. And he told me that his entire life he had been a hunter. His entire life his family had hunted for meat. They had never bought meat in a store in their entire lives. And he was telling me these stories about how his grandfather taught him how to respectfully take game, how to not leave anything behind, how to be respectful of the earth. And he was saying these things that as a Native American person, I resonated with. And it struck me that my position about needing to ban every single gun and take them all away from everybody could no longer hold. Do we need to examine our policing policies? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Do we need to think about gun policies in relation to people being able to carry in any place that might be dangerous? Certainly. But I could not maintain the position that all guns needed to go away because I recognized that I was going to be taking away a valuable piece of this young man's life, culture, emotional experience.
What I think you're also demonstrating there is that engaged listening will never happen if you believe the stereotype, right? Because that's the conversation ender.
Right. And going back to Eddie's earlier point, one of the things that this work tries to do is it tries to create a space, a place, a vessel by which these conversations can even begin. Because for the most part, we don't have any space in this culture that allows for those conversations to happen.
For sure.
If at all, aside from maybe arguing with people on Facebook or putting something on Twitter. There's very little space for us to legitimately come together as different groups of people and talk to each other.
Let me get to Zoe in St. Paul. Hi, Zoe. Thanks so much for waiting. Curious about what you're going to say here.
Thank you for taking my phone call. I would say that as this country become more colorful, and I think both parties have to look beyond the race and ethnicity and embrace the fundamental values that people believe. If you say hardworking whites and lazy brown blacks, for those people who belong to brown and black, they're hardworking, they're conservative. Maybe they will think, oh, maybe I should jump to the other side because I believe in hardworking conservative values. And versus, not all whites are hardworking either.
Yeah.
So I would think that. Well, Democratic Party should play less of identity politics because, people in brown and black have different, have other values, too. So
good
that kind of divided up the traditional Democratic basis into two divisions, and some of people may jump to the other side. For Republican Party, they should embrace all these people that share the same conservative and hardworking values. So that's my point.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really appreciate the call. I want to get to Vicky in Cloquet because, Vicky, I know you've been waiting for a while, too. Tell me how you're thinking about this.
I'm a black female who's married to a white male, and we've been married for 25 years. And members of my husband's family voted for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And when I found this out, I cried literally for 3 days. I felt, how could these people that I've been related to fall prey to this person? How could they support someone who said things about, brown and black people like me? I was just devastated.
This is a real test, right? Of family bonds here.
Oh, my gosh. I was devastated. We were due to go home for Thanksgiving. I didn't want to go. I was sick. It was really a struggle. And I had to take a step back and say, you know what? Some of the issues that were important to them, like gun control and things like that, aren't important to me, but they're very important to them. But these are the same people who took care of me for 6 weeks after my hysterectomy, you know, who are wonderful grandparents to my children.
They love you.
They love
right?
me. They love me. These are the same people who have loved me for almost 25 years. And I realized that, you know, people are multifaceted, and they are more than just any one decision that anyone makes, myself included. And I realized that I was being mean to my husband and, you know, being all self-righteous. And sometimes you really got to look at yourself and look at other people. And if you try to boil it down to the least common denominator, you're not going to get anywhere. And families are being destroyed over one decision. And because we can't talk to each other, nothing is getting accomplished.
So, Vicki, what was the Thanksgiving table like last year? And what, now that you've had the realization, might it be like this year?
You know, I didn't say boo. You know, I can fake it as well as the next person.
Okay.
You know, I didn't want there to be disharmony at the family table. But I've been able to have some really real conversations with people and to help them to try to see things from my point of view. I grew up in the city. My husband grew up in the country. You know, we have lots of things where our upbringings and our views on things were different, but we found love and we built a family. And we have to keep that in the forefront and not let things like this destroy us, because if this country does not come together to where we can have difficult conversations about difficult topics, we're not going to go forward. And we can't go back.
So glad you called. Vicki, thank you. Eddie, what do you hear in that?
I mean, it's a kind of distillation of what is happening all over the country. You know, love is an exacting emotion, right? It triumphs over so much of the messiness of human doings and sufferings, you know? But also, you know, human beings are complex. You know, folks can love you and still hold noxious views. And those views can be made explicit in the most unexpected moments. It's how can I put this, Carrie? We're at a conjuncture. The country is fundamentally changing.
Mm-hmm.
Something is dying, and something is being born. And we just and both processes are very, very painful. But, you know, and as the country changes, some folks are going to want to hold on to what they're familiar with. And some folks are going to rush forward into the future. I think the main thing is for us to kind of leave behind the certainty of our views. When we think we got it right, when we think we know the truth,
uh-huh.
is when all the trouble happens. It's not just simply stereotypes.
It's
the kind of arrogance that's caught up with, I got the answer. And because I know I have the answer, only thing I need to do is tell people the answer and not listen to folks. Donald Trump has let the genie out of the bottle. That messy underside of American life is now in full view. And our task is not to put the genie back in the bottle. Is to rid ourselves of it so that I can actually have a conversation with a conservative about the role of government without me assuming that the conservative is actually engaging me in bad faith.
Eddie, I'm always grateful for the clarity and the insight. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Joaquin, thank you. Really nice to meet you and hear about the work that you're doing at Better Angels. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the insight that you brought to the conversation. All right, we're flipping it at 11 o'clock, and we'll be talking about the labels that Democrats bear, whether you think they're fair. Republicans, I want to hear from you that hour as well. 651-227-6000. See you at 11.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.